Good afternoon, everyone. Since we have some folks that are joining us virtually today, I think we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to Homecoming. My name is Ellie Swain Ballard, class of 95, and I work in the alumni office. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to Karee Polk, the Robert E. Kiter 1957 Postdoctoral Fellow and Visiting Assistant Professor of Black Studies. As I mentioned, in addition to those who are sitting here in Stern Auditorium for this lecture, we are joined by many alumni and parents by phone or computer as part of our virtual lecture series. Professor Polk received his PhD in American Studies from New York University and is currently writing a book on race, sexuality, and the U.S. military abroad. He has written for the African American Review, Women's Studies Quarterly, the Studio Museum of Harlem, If We Have to Take Tomorrow, Corpus, Think Again, and the Journal of Negro History. His doctoral thesis, Subaltern Soldiers, Race, Sexuality, and American Militarism in the Early to Mid-20th Century, focused upon the transnational movement of African-American soldiers from 1898 to the end of World War II, and demonstrated how the U.S. military's presence of overseas basing helped to produce modern forms of both Black diaspora and African-American masculinity. At Amherst, he has taught Introduction to Black Studies, which combines the teaching of foundational texts in the field with instruction in reading and writing, as well as Black Sexualities, a course that explores how the category of sexuality acts as an additional optic through which to view and reframe contemporary and historical debates concerning the construction of Black identity. Today, he will be focusing on the hidden regimes of discrimination Black soldiers experienced abroad from the Spanish-American War to World War II, a largely overlooked history that he looks forward to sharing with you. After Professor Polk's remarks, we will take questions from the audience, both here in Stern and via the webinar. For those joining by computer, please type a question into the questions section. You may need to expand the control panel on your screen. Professor Polk will repeat questions from the audience in Stern so those joining remotely can hear. Please join me in welcoming Professor Polk.
Thank you all so much. I'd like to thank the Alumni Office for inviting me here to participate in this virtual lecture series, and happy homecoming. And I'd also like to thank all the alumni and parents who've come out today, and as well as those listening via the internet. I think my parents are out there somewhere, too, so hi, Mom and Dad. I appreciate this opportunity to share my work with you, my work in progress, and I look forward to engaging with you all and hearing your insights, comments, and observation. I'd like also just to point out that this lecture is an excerpt from my larger work that I'm working on based upon my dissertation. It's from a chapter entitled Easy to Get, Race, American Militarism, and the Black Venereal Body Abroad. Immunity, contagion, communicability, and containment are intertwined themes that mark the movement of African-American male soldiers across time and space in the 20th century. My talk today will examine three moments in which these themes saturated the history of African-American military service abroad. First, I will discuss the Spanish-American-Cuban War of 1898 and the related Philippine War of Independence, where Black soldiers' contact with Filipino nationals breached boundaries of race, nation, and language. Next, I move to France during World War I and show how white American officers attempted to eliminate interracial sexual contact from occurring between Black troops and French women through the punitive use of anti-venereal drugs. Finally, I focus upon World War II, where U.S. military doctors employed a new class of medicines known as sulfa drugs to regulate the sexual movement of African-American soldiers around the world. I should also add a clarifying note regarding two terms I've just mentioned, immunity and contagion. In my larger manuscript, I explore the implications of immunity as functioning as a rights-based discourse that depended upon the ritual sacrifice of the Black soldier in combat. And I demonstrate that I demonstrate how this sacrifice was trumpeted by African-American leaders like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois as evidence that black folks deserved full and active citizenship rights on the home front. And in my book-length project, I also trace the use of contagion as a metaphor for the spread of U.S. culture by African-American soldiers as they moved beyond the boundaries of the nation-state. And the introduction of jazz music to France is one salient example that I explore in depth. Today, however, I'd like to focus upon the biological connotations of these terms. White officers' use of black troops, both as a servile labor force as well as test subjects in experimental drug trials, is evidence that U.S. military leaders were engaged in a transnational program of biomedical citizenship with regard to the health and bodies of African-American soldiers. Biomedical citizenship is a term employed by medical historian Warwick Anderson to define the relationship between white American doctors in the Philippines in the early 20th century and the Filipinos they attempted to civilize and reform through intensive regulations on personal hygiene and social conduct. In a similar vein, my study shows the links U.S. military doctors would go to prove their global technological supremacy through the sexual regulation of African-American soldiers abroad. As such, this story is not only concerned with chronicling modern practices of racial discrimination. Rather, I show how these practices were representative of an American military need to showcase its technocratic might on a world stage. But to begin, I'd like to briefly consider the importance of a training film produced exclusively for black soldiers in World War II that provides the title of my talk, 1943's Easy to Get. As an educational aid, Easy to Get was meant to instruct new black recruits in ways to protect themselves against sexually transmitted or venereal diseases, which had been shown to be the leading cause of sick leave among American military personnel since the First World War. The film follows the travails of two black soldiers stuck in the VD dispensary under the care of a white officer, who painstakingly explains to both men how they caught their sexually transmitted infections, gonorrhea and syphilis, respectively. As a cinematic document, Easy to Get exemplifies ways in which the themes of race, sexuality, citizenship, and disease intersected within the figure of the African-American male soldier. It also marked an attempt by the U.S. military elite to marshal racial pride as a fulcrum for behavioral change and disease prevention. At the time the film was made, military officials were aware that the training aids used in conjunction with VD educational programs lacked maximum effectiveness because they were aimed primarily at white soldiers. In response, they suggested that, quote, psychological appeals for the avoidance of venereal disease, end quote, should be used in media directed towards black troops. Among those appeals were racial pride, competitive spirit, and patriotism. Using sports as an analogy for excellent sexual health, the film showed black boxer Joe Louis beating Hitler's boy, Max Schmeling, in their 1938 rematch as a testament to Louis's clean health and physical fitness. Keeping clean means keeping healthy, the narrator said, and it was good health that beat the Germans before the war even started. The film showed clips of the 1936 Berlin Olympics and sung the praises of African-American athletes Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf, who, quote, all knew the value of a good health and staying clean. Turning venereal disease into a metaphor for the Axis powers, U.S. military authorities hoped to galvanize race pride and patriotism as effective preventives against VD. The training film ends with a stern lecture given by internationally renowned actor Paul Robeson, who likened the films the soldiers had been watching to the lectures on sexual health he received from his football coach 20 years past, before they had pictures like this. Quote, he gave it to us hot and heavy and we took it, Robeson said, because if you want to play football, you've got to have a healthy body. Robeson then admitted that this particular film, with its graphic depiction of genital deformities and bodily diseases, was indeed frightening, but not as frightening as the War Department statistics he'd seen on black rates of VD. We've got to do something about this, he implored. and we have the answer. Speaking as an elder statesman as well as a race man, Robeson chided the newest generation of African-American soldiers to remember the lessons of prevention described in the film for themselves, their families, and their communities. He ended his broadside simply, "We must defeat VD." Yet the kind of sexual control military officials hoped to engender in African-American male soldiers through the dissemination of race-specific media was only the most recent 20th century attempt to curb what had been understood and quantified by military doctors as both a socially constructed and biologically determined tendency towards sexual excessiveness. Easy to get's cast of characters, the callow corporal, the promiscuous private, and the paternalistic white doctor, were pliable archetypes drawn from earlier interfaces between African-American soldiers and white American officers serving abroad in Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and France. And it's to these moments I'd now like to turn. At the turn of the 20th century, African-American men were mobilized and saw foreign combat for the first time in American history under the War Department's erroneous belief that they carried a natural immunity against yellow fever and malaria, and thus were well suited to labor in the tropical climates of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. Now, part of this belief came from the idea that since most of the recruits were from the South, that they'd have a natural resistance to these tropical diseases. But it's also important to note that this myth of black immunity stretched back centuries. It was, in fact, central to the logics of racial slavery, which presumed that the bodies of people of African descent were naturally predisposed to survive the hard labors of servitude as well as contagious diseases. To be sure, African Americans had varying ideas about what their war participation meant for their status in a white supremacist nation, one that had traded radical Reconstruction for the Jim Crow politics of white Southern redemption. While African-American leaders like Booker T. Washington jumped at the chance for black soldiers to fight in what had been described by many as a white man's war, the idea of immune regiments struck some volunteers like N.C. Bruce as a cynical attempt to get blacks into service. Their role, Bruce mused, would be akin to that of, quote, mules and oxen. The military would use them for only heat and heavy hauling. In practice, black troops proved no more resistant to the foreign climate than did white Americans. One of the first quarantine camps for the yellow fever patients in Cuba was staffed by black soldiers of the 24th Infantry, who were volunteered for the duty after eight other white regiments refused to care for the growing number of sick men. This resulted in 167 men contracting yellow fever, 23 deaths, and 40 disability discharges. In addition, 32 African-American women, five of whom were trained at the Tuskegee Institute, were sent to Cuba to nurse black soldiers sickened with the disease. These women were thought to be immune from the fevers since they had had the disease previously, but at least two of the nurses died in service to the immune regiments. The myth of racial immunity that the War Department invoked within the discourse of African-American military service made way for the fear of communicability between black soldiers and the foreign people they encountered on their imperial sojourns around the world. In other words, U.S. war hawks feared that their black soldiers, who were deeply familiar with the social and political violence underpinning Jim Crow segregation, would find racial and social affinity with those they met while serving in the U.S. empire overseas. Indeed, they had good reason to worry. Despite the difficulty black soldiers faced in acclimating to Cuba's environment, many of the letters that they wrote to the American press back home spoke about the affable relations between themselves and Cuban nationals. George Beard of the 8th Illinois Infantry found that the barrier of linguistic difference became permeable as soon as African-American soldiers developed proficiency in Spanish. He wrote that soldiers acted as interpreters for their non-Spanish-speaking fellows and noted with considerable zeal that, quote, if the people in Springfield could hear Corporals Morgan and Moss talking to these Cubans, they would think that they had studied the language at some college. They talk so fluently. The acquisition of Spanish in Cuba by African-American soldiers no doubt aided them when all four black regiments were redeployed to the Philippines in 1899. Richard Johnson of the 48th Volunteer Infantry found that black soldiers had some success in traversing the linguistic divide between themselves and the Filipino population. In addition to Spanish, the soldiers also began to learn the local languages Tagalog and Ilocano. "While I did better than some in learning the native language," Johnson wrote, "there were others who did far better than this. A few showed remarkable aptitude for these dialects, and strangely enough, these were generally the less educated ones," end quote. However, war correspondent Stephen Bonzel noted that the surprising linguistic facility of black troops in foreign lands came to be regarded as anything but a subject for congratulation. He thought that African-American soldiers had, quote, "got on much too well with the little brown sisters," end quote, as evidenced by the number of marriages occurring between black men and Filipino women. The idea that African-American soldiers might become united to the Filipino population by the tenderest of ties stoked fears among white American officers that African-American soldiers were in closer sympathy with the aims of the native population than they were with those of their white leaders and the policy of the United States. The War Department found the proof it was looking for by referencing the rise in venereal disease rates among black troops, which increased from 114 per thousand per annum in 1897 to 270 per thousand per annum in 1902. They would also cite incidents of black desertion, none more spectacular than the case of David Fagan, who defected from the 24th Infantry in November 1899 and fought against the United States for 2 years as an officer in Emilio Aguinaldo's army. Through the language of the state, immunity was much more than a feint of racial chauvinism used to allow black participation in the war effort on conditional terms. It was also a way to classify African-American servicemen as disease-resistant mules of warfare, whose military impotence ensured that they would remain footnotes in history. It should be remembered, however, that while the discourse of black immunity arose from an economic need for a reserve labor force, this need was buttressed by a racially coded belief that these descendants of slaves were members of an already diseased race, and as such, carried a natural, passive immunity against the fevers that felled white soldiers in 1898. The deployment of African-American soldiers outside the territorial boundaries of the United States at the turn of the century rendered those immune bodies into communicable subjects and agents of American empire. And it is this understanding of the African-American soldier as communicable that portends the shift from immunity towards contagion in the history of African-American military service abroad during World War I. With the military theater of engagement moving from the Philippines to Europe in 1917, fresh concerns about interracial contact occurring in France between black soldiers and French white women created an entirely new source of anxiety among white American soldiers and officers. In fact, Amherst alum Charles Hamilton Houston, who was one of the 390,000 African American soldiers serving in France during World War I, encountered just this kind of discrimination when he and three other black officers found themselves surrounded by white soldiers in the city of Vannes, who berated them with racial epithets and threatened to lynch them over the allegation that they had been fraternizing with white French women. Houston would later write of this incident, quote, "I made up my mind that I would never get caught again without knowing something about my rights, that if luck was with me and I got through this war, I would study law and use my time fighting for men who could not strike back," end quote. It should be noted, however, that such anxieties about interracial contact were not only present in the lynch mob mentalities of white soldiers on liberty passes. They also informed the creation of official U.S. military medical policy and the practice of U.S. public health. White Army doctors who treated African-American soldiers during the Great War were instrumental in institutionalizing the idea of the quote-unquote Negro venereal within medical and military discourse. They authorized their experiences and opinions in medical journals and at professional conferences once the First World War had officially ended and they returned to their civilian lives. George Day, a physician who treated patients at Camp Pike in Arkansas and Camp Alexander in Virginia, said at the 71st meeting of the American Medical Association in 1920 that, quote, "It is my belief that practically all Negroes are venereals. Why this is true is quite easily understood. Furthermore, it is my belief that comparatively few are ever cured of venereal disease. When an occasional one is cured, he betakes himself to his usual haunts to become quickly reinfected. I am convinced that the majority of Negroes do not respect the moral code of or honor the sanctity of wedlock. So the endless chain of infection and reinfection goes merrily along." War Department statistics for rates of venereal disease during World War I do show a large proportionate difference between black and white soldiers. Out of 63,000 servicemen hospitalized for venereal disease in 1917, over 59,000 were white and 4,000 were black, allowing for a rate of 109 per thousand for white troops compared to 310 for blacks. Now, these stats were fiercely contested both by black soldiers as well as their advocates on the ground, like Addie Hunton and Catherine Johnson, two African-American club women who volunteered for the YMCA in France during the war. But even if we take these numbers at face value, I'd argue for the importance of acknowledging the disadvantages of social class when considering these statistics, as most African-American draftees had little to no access to health care. If there were proportionally higher rates of venereal infections among black troops, this is likely because blacks were accepted for war service with health conditions that would have excused whites. Draft boards in the United States shared the general belief that most black men were venereals, so if there was to be a black draft, it would have to take them, diseases and all. But whatever the extent to which venereal disease was a pre-existing condition for some African-American servicemen during World War I, it's important to note that the sexual circulation of African-American troops, reflected by their rates of venereal disease in France, stimulated already extant racial anxieties among a white officer elite during the war. Now, up until World War I, the transmission of diseases such as syphilis and gonorrhea during military conflicts had become a readily accepted fact of modern warfare. However, General John Pershing, commander-in-chief of the American Expeditionary Force, believed that a fight against venereal diseases had to be waged in order for America to win the war. In order to make the AEF the cleanest army in the world, American doctors adopted new and novel treatments to safeguard American soldiers from VD. The centerpiece of these treatments involved the use of what was known as chemical prophylaxis, an experimental method of curtailing venereal infection after possible exposure through the direct application of chemical preventives on the genitalia. At special prophylactic stations, silver compounds believed to have antiseptic qualities were injected into the patient's penis through the urethra and held for 5 minutes. Afterwards, mercury chloride was rubbed over the external genitalia for 3 more minutes. Now, if this sounds gruesome, it was meant to be. Urologist Hugh Fampton Young and George Walker theorized that the administration of prophylaxis had not only therapeutic but also behavioral effects upon the sexual conduct of soldiers, writing that, quote, "much of the glamour and romance of illicit love will be lost when men can be impressed with the necessity of prophylactic measures after each exposure." Walker continues, "for by so doing, the association of the act with disease, gonorrhea, syphilis, and chancroid is established, and once an idea such as that is planted, it is apt to grow and keep the individual constantly face to face with the sordid danger of venereal infection and all of the degradation and suffering it may cause not only to him, but to those who are dear to him." As evidence of their technocratic victory over VD during the war, Walker and Young cited the reduction of high rates of venereal disease among African-American stevedores stationed at Saint-Nazaire, France, and later in the port cities of Brest and Bordeaux through the use of chemical prophylaxis. Saint-Nazaire was the first seaport base expropriated for American use during the war, and its medical officers were aware as early as October 1917 that its men were contracting high rates of venereal disease. Upon learning that, quote, the French women apparently had no aversion to colored troops, end quote, Young recommended a number of measures implemented that December, which specifically restricted the movement of African-American soldiers in the port city. He ordered a barbed wire stockade to be built around the stevedore camp, and guards were placed at the entrance, affording complete control of the men themselves. Whenever a soldier left the confines of the camp for any reason, he was required to take a prophylactic treatment upon his return. The effects of compulsory prophylaxis were deemed magical, according to Walker, and gave results which were not dreamed possible. Young agreed, writing in his autobiography that compulsory prophylaxis had an instantaneous effect on the venereal rate, rapidly reducing it until, quote, it was as good or better than that of the white troops. While the effects of such measures did lead to a decrease in the rate of venereal disease among African-American soldiers, it is difficult to ascertain whether these effects were brought about due to prophylaxis itself or the intense restriction of movement placed upon black soldiers living and working in the port cities of France, limiting the access these soldiers had to the sexual commerce the war engendered, in which venereal disease operated as one powerful sign or receipt of exchange. Punitive attempts by this core power bloc to discipline the bodies of African-American soldiers indicate that the Negro venereal was consolidating within the civil military discourse with all the coherence of a species. The medical apparatus of the U.S. military became a vital arbiter of the overlapping taxonomies of race, class, gender, and citizenship in America. When it authorized efforts to restrict the movement of African-American soldiers in France, it played a central role and the technical, biological, and political regulation and containment of African-American soldiers abroad. By the onset of World War II, a new class of drugs for the treatment of venereal infections had been invented, and they were known as sulfa drugs. Because they could be taken orally, they were lauded as an important advance over the invasive application of sulfur compounds and mercury chloride during World War I. African-American soldiers were yet again part of significant clinical trials of anti-venereal drugs in World War II. In 1943, Captain James Lovelace and Colonel William Denton, both of the U.S. Army's Medical Corps, published results of a study on the use of sulfa drugs as a prophylaxis against gonorrhea in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Approximately 5,400 African-American troops at Fort Benning, Georgia, were participants in the experiment, with 1,400 in the test group and 4,000 in the control group. Much as in World War I, the administration of sulfa drugs to the test group was connected to soldiers leaving and returning to the fort on their liberty passes, under the assumption that any time off base would be spent engaged in sexual activity. This study, alongside a similar experiment conducted in Fort Knox, Kentucky, pioneered the use of sulfa drugs as a prophylaxis against gonorrhea and chancroid by the U.S. military. The success of these experiments stateside encouraged U.S. military doctors to employ liberal use of the drug in the different theaters of World War II. In the official military medical history of the war, Thomas Sternberg writes that three typical Negro organizations were part of a three-month sulfa drug trial in 1943. The encouraging results produced through the experiments further advanced the use of sulfa drugs overseas and followed the march of black soldiers throughout Europe, the Mediterranean, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, China, India, Burma, and Pacific Ocean nations. Soon, sulfa drugs would also be used in tandem with penicillin to treat most venereal infections, mediating the social and sexual relationships between black soldiers and the people they met in high-rate countries such as Italy, Liberia, and Iran. By 1944, the chief consultant in medicine to the U.S. Army would state that, quote, from a military standpoint, no more important development in therapeutics has occurred than in the field of venereal disease. to close, through the biological use of their bodies and the physical extraction of their labor, African-American soldiers became the focus of biomedical citizenship projects and U.S. military campaigns waged abroad in the early to mid-20th century. Viewed in successive historical moments as both contagious and immune, black troops came in contact with the world globalized through the technological advances in communication, medicine, travel, and warfare. And this in turn shaped their own ideas about race, sexuality, and citizenship. Read by a white military elite as sexually and culturally contagious, and possibly even multilingual, these soldiers were subjected to intensive modes of regulation and discipline on their travels outside the nation state. The fear that these mules might become men through military service outside of the United States might very well account for the promulgation of the myth of the infectious venereal body generating within American military and medical histories well into the 20th century. What is clear is that in the 43 years from the start of the Spanish-American War to the beginning of World War II, African-American soldiers remained important rhetorical and material vehicles for a number of agents and figured prominently in the discourse spawned from America's imperial ambitions. Thank you so much. So the question was for our friends on the internet, how did these experiences impact the identity of African American men in the United States? It actually had a direct implication, particularly during World War I, because the notion of the black soldier as being this venereal body was fiercely contested both by the soldiers themselves and by a number of their advocates. And so what you ended up having, and a lot of the media produced by black organizations such as W.E.B. Du Bois's The Crisis, was the use of the figure of the clean black soldier. And so the idea of the clean black soldier as a figure that was pure began to be used by black organizations and black leaders as a way of showing that black men were fit for citizenship. And that itself also connected to the discourse of the progressive discourse that was happening in the moment as well. And so I think that there was a direct way in which black masculinity was impacted back on the home front in terms of what it meant to be ready to be ready to receive full and active citizenship rights from the nation. And so there was a way in which both fighting in the war and then coming home was a way in which the sense of masculinity was connected to being clean. So this notion of cleanliness and citizenship went hand in hand. The question was, how many black troops served during World War I? The number that I've seen has been somewhere between 390,000, 380,000, 390,000. Then during World War II, the number, I believe, moves to a little over a million. But during World War II, all of those black soldiers didn't travel the world, but numbers of them did. Close to a million. I've seen it's about a million point two.
About a million?
That's what I've seen. A quick little Wikipedia. If I had it, I could probably make sure that was correct. But I believe that it definitely was more than half than the black soldiers served during World War One. The question was, were these drugs, the silver compounds and the mercury chloride, were they used on white soldiers? Yes, they were. The difference is that for white soldiers, it was by choice. And so if you felt as though that you had an exposure, you could then go and say, please, I need a treatment. And there was a way in which General Pershing linked the individual success of units to the cleanliness of each unit's men. So it actually was something that being clean had a real impact, particularly for the officers of the different regiments. And so people were very, very conscious of the fact that they needed to remain clean, because it would reflect badly not just upon themselves, but upon their total unit's performance. The question was, could I speak a bit about what is known as the Tuskegee experiment, and say a little bit about that? So the Tuskegee experiment, and there's even controversy, I should say, about having Tuskegee, you know, being the leading phrase in that, yeah. As opposed to there's a longer title. But that was a study that began in 1932. By the Public Health Service, and it was it took about, I believe the number, it was 299 African-American men who had tested positive for syphilis. What happened during that experiment, which lasted, they wanted to actually see what the long-standing effects of syphilis in the black body, in the black male body. And because the idea was that it would, syphilis treated different bodies, different racialized bodies differently. And the men themselves were not aware that they were being treated for this purpose. And a lot of the controversy comes in the fact that they themselves didn't consent to this experiment, and they didn't know that they were being tested for the long-standing effects of syphilis. Now, what I think is actually important for my study is that that during World War II, during the draft, about 250 of the men received draft notices. And when you received draft notices, it meant that actually you were treated by a doctor, and if you were found to have a treatable disease, you were treated. The doctors that were part of the experiment, they actually went to their superiors and said that, listen, these men, we need these men for this longer experiment. So we would rather them be exempted from military service than be treated for the syphilis that they had. So it's really interesting when you begin to think that there were decisions made that these men were more valuable for this study than they were as actual troops that would fight for democracy abroad. Yes, the question I spoke a bit about the films that were used for black soldiers. Were there comparable films for white soldiers? There were, and actually one of the funny things they found out is that those films were not only were those films not particularly effective for black soldiers, but white soldiers were bored by them too. Eventually both white and black soldiers really preferred this film, Easy to Get. The other films, they were really, really ideologically driven. I think one was called In Defense of Nation. And so it was the idea that you have to remain clean for your nation, for your family. They weren't as exciting as this particular film. I mean, I have to admit that this film is really well made, and it was a film that was made in consultation with members of the War Department who were advocated specifically for African American soldiers. So the War Department actually heard the critique that these films, the previous films, you know, they didn't work. And so you actually, while there's no one famous within this film, you do see that the you know, there's a dance scene, you know, you have all these clips of Jesse Owens and Paul Robeson, and it's something that people really got into, and so that itself, to me, I just find
fascinating that that this was something that that was co-signed and by both white military folks and black military folks. Okay, I'm going to try to recap that. No, it's all good. So the question is about speaking about the paradox of black soldiers and the bodies of black soldiers being seen as both venereal disease and carriers of venereal disease, as well as the fact that they are also what the last part of that. I'm sorry. And that they were also model bodies for a scientific experiment. I think it is interesting. I think that what I would say is that it connects back to the notion of biological citizenship. That in some ways that these bodies that they actually had a use value for a larger notion of technological progress. There's arguments made that American military doctors, that they were always, in some ways, looking up to the successes of European doctors and European scientists, and historically. And so World War I was a moment in which American doctors were able to claim a kind of technological superiority. And what I think that one of the things that they did in that moment is they modeled their treatment of black soldiers in the way that the European colonial powers treated their own colonial soldiers. So in fact, even the technique of chemical prophylaxis was a technique that was used by officers from New Zealand. And so there is kind of a sense of saying that, well, you know, we see the way you all can treat your colonial people, and now we have our own colonial people as well. And the notion of biological citizenship is interesting because the idea is that through a kind of attention to changing the morals of the population, that you can actually bring them up to becoming full and active citizens. And I think that so part of the paradox involved in using these black soldiers in this way is that, yes, we know that their actual tendencies, you know, quote unquote, we know that their tendencies are towards this sexual excessiveness. And yet, through technological progress and strictness, moral strictness, we can actually bring them up to the level of proper and upright citizens. Now, that itself, I think, is interesting because you also do have numbers of African-American leaders who sign on to that project, who themselves believe that, yes, that we have to do something to change the morality of the mass of African-Americans. So there is this paradox, I think, that goes on, that in some ways that you need a reserve population of people in order to treat. And it's through the treatment of these people that you create citizens that are worthy of the citizenship rights that have often been denied them. I'm not sure if that I may have missed a little bit, but please come back to me.
Black soldier, or was he being hypocritical in his leadership?
Right. The question was about General Pershing, who's known by many of, I guess, of his other generals as Blackjack Pershing, because he commanded black soldiers. Yeah, he seems like a very interesting guy because he also served in Mexico. And when he served in Mexico, he himself had a different perspective on treating venereal disease. One, he believed in regulated prostitution, which happened upon the border in Mexico. And it wasn't until he actually was going to France, and Hugh Hampton Young, who is known as the father of modern neurology, happened to actually get a chance to go be on the same ship to France as General Pershing, and he himself was responsible for holding several lectures on venereal disease, and apparently they were known very terrifying, and so Pershing himself, at that moment, it was that ship, traveling to France, he had basically, you know, become an acolyte of Young's ideology, and so he, I don't really see it as something in terms of him being a hypocrite. In fact, he really wanted the entire AEF to be the cleanest army in the world. And he often, apparently, according to letters that I've read in the Chicago Defender, black soldiers said that, you know, that General Pershing made an inspection of our camp, and he would say things like, you know, you all are the cleanest, group of men I've seen, and in fact, you all are cleaner than a lot of white troops that I've seen, and for that you should be commended. So he seemed to really occupy kind of an ambivalent status. In terms of his role within here, but he definitely signed on to the notion that American men needed to be clean in terms of morals and sexuality and venereal disease during World War One.
How does it affect women? Do they also have a biological citizenship, and how did that come about?
This is a great question. The question was about biological citizenship and whether or not that's a concept that I came up with, or is that in the literature. That is actually a concept in the literature. And Warwick Anderson, he writes in his book Colonial Pathologies, and he talks about American doctors who remained in the Philippines both during the Spanish-American War or the related War of Philippine Independence, and how their own ways of trying to bring notions of sanitary sanitation to the Philippines created or attempted to create a population of that really respected the idea of cleanliness, hygiene, and ways that they believed that they hadn't before. And so that there was a ways in which I think that women themselves were part of that logic. And so the way in which I began to think about that is that it definitely is a part of the discourse in terms of thinking about women moving from World War One to World War Two, because what you end up finding is that in World War One, you begin to see the way in which the black soldiers are seen as vectors of disease, and French women in some ways are incidental to that. During World War II, you really do begin to see the way in which women are painted as vectors of disease, and particularly women in certain spaces, such as women in Iran and women in Liberia. Even though that you actually have large rates of sexually transmitted diseases going on around the world due to the mobilization of the war, women begin to become the subjects in need of regulation. And so the notion of regulation, I think, comes across in terms of what we think about biological citizenship as well. In addition, during World War One and World War Two, you have a number of acts that are passed on military bases stateside that say that, well, if there are red light districts, that they themselves, you know, they have to be raised. And so you have a important example during 1917. The Secretary of the Navy says that Storyville in New Orleans needs to be shut down. Because it's a known red light district, and having this red light district continuing to be in existence is a threat to all soldiers. So I do think that the citizenship project is something that it operates differently in terms of gender, but there are certain narratives, I think, you know, that are definitely comparable. Well, I would say that, it's biomedical citizenship, so I have to keep that in mind. And I would also say that in some ways, that particularly when it's practiced by or understood by African Americans, that it's an aspirational citizenship in a sense. And so the idea was that upon our return, we will be seen as clean, healthy, fit men. And because of that we will actually be able to have these rights that have so long been denied to us. In fact, both during World War I and World War II, there's kind of a, you might almost call it a depression that sets in because this, in fact, did not happen. Particularly the idea of just of black soldiers wearing uniforms in the stateside, it created so much tension. I mean, there are numbers of black men who were lynched simply, by the fact that they were in public wearing their dress uniforms, their dress blues. And so there's so much effort that's placed upon black soldiers to have them remain in their place after wartime service. And this is something that happens from 1898, all the way up until World War II. In fact, my research, I haven't quite gotten to the Korean War, but I know that up until World War II, that this was something that was definitely part of the discourse, that despite, maybe even actually because of their experiences abroad, that black soldiers and black veterans became targets. And Richard Wright actually writes in his novel Black Boy that there are certain things that, that even though that, in the South, you can have lots of black people and white people can talk about numbers of things together, but there are certain things that you don't talk about. One, you don't talk about France, and two, you don't talk about white French women. Those are two topics that you cannot have a conversation about because someone's life literally may be on the line. The question is, if during World War I, if you were a black man in the draft, did you register? You did, actually. You did register. I'm not exactly sure about the process of the draft, but one of the great things about the archives, the National Archives website, is that you can actually search draft cards. And so you actually see a number of jazz musicians who their draft cards are available. In fact, actually, I found Charles Hamilton Houston's draft card, where he talks about his D.C. address, which is kind of amazing to be able to see that. And in fact, you had certain people such as James Reese Europe, who was a Harlem band leader, famous Harlem band leader during the early 19-teens, who decided that he and his co-leader, Noble Sissel, that they would join up. They themselves decided to join up during the war effort because they thought that by doing so, that it would bring them more acclaim and accolades. And they themselves then became part of they led the Harlem Hellfighters, which is the jazz band that brought, quote-unquote, brought jazz to France. And it was an amazing band in its composition because it had both African Americans soldiers as well as like Puerto Rican soldiers. And Europe had actually he went explicitly to Puerto Rico in order to get Puerto Ricans who apparently thought of being like the best reed players. And so you had these soldiers who actually traveled France, and they themselves had more license than most soldiers, black or white, in order to circulate around France because they became the representative face of America. And so you have moments where they're in small towns and performing concerts. And I think one of the greatest stories about that moment is when they themselves they traveled to France on the ship Pocahontas. And once they arrived at the shore, they played and while you can call it jazz, in reality it was ragtime, and they played a ragged version of the French national anthem, the La Marseillaise, I guess. My French is horrible, excuse me. But they played it in such a way that that the French sailors on at shore, they had no idea what they were playing. And so they're just like, okay, well, they're black soldiers playing something. And it's not until around maybe they're sort of maybe, I don't know, like maybe five or six measures into it, that the soldiers realize what's going on and they snap to attention because they realize that they're hearing their own national anthem. And so that itself was one of the ways in which the notion of jazz began to really circulate in France. And so it becomes really fascinating, to see the kind of choices that people made to have a sense of citizenship that then began to travel and do things, in some ways beyond their own control. I believe so. Definitely during World War II. I'm just not sure, I'm not exactly sure about the draft structure during World War I. So the question is basic, a question about return in terms of what happened when African Americans returned home. Did the experiences that they had, were the experiences in the military, you know, better and or worse than what they were experiencing stateside? And they themselves, you know, what impact did they have upon the civil rights movement? I mean, I think that those are fascinating questions, and I think that at the time there was so much. Possibility for black soldiers and black people during World War I. You actually had numbers of black leaders who actually wanted to join up. W.E. Du Bois himself tried to you know, himself he was a firm critic of the U.S. military, and he himself wrote a editorial called "In the Crisis" that said, "It's time for us to close ranks with white America. Let us forget our special grievances. This is a moment where, you know, we need to come together in order to fight." And I think that when they came back, you know, in addition to the moments of dealing with lynching and racial discrimination, there was a way there, at least for at least in Harlem in that moment, you begin to see that the impact of World War I really helped to lead to the Harlem Renaissance. And so you began to sort of realize that there was a larger scope, a sort of a black internationalist vision that occurred because black soldiers had seen more than they had expected to see. So you actually, during World War I, you have black soldiers seeing other black colonial troops. And so you begin to think about, you know, how the idea of just of speaking French became something that, you know, was this new language in order to understand oneself. During World War II and after World War II, I think that you can talk about the way in which that the returning black soldiers began to connect to the idea of the civil rights movement. And this is actually something that is not only clear in terms of African-American soldiers, but also lots of colonial soldiers who return, because the idea of after fighting and returning to the same lot that you were before, returning to your place, just wasn't a possibility. And so there's ways in which I think that, particularly in Africa, numbers of anti-colonial movements occurred because soldiers returned back home and they were asked to be a part of a caste system again. And this itself just was not acceptable. And in the United States, it happens in a similar way, where people say that, listen, no, we can't. You know, we've learned too much. In addition to the idea that, you know, that now there are many black people who held guns, which itself was a huge issue, the idea of black people with guns, that there is also just a larger knowledge. And I think that the movement around the world, it really began to teach American soldiers and African-American soldiers that there was a global color line. But the color line itself was different in different places. And the idea that they were able to interact and get friendly receptions in so many places around the world changed their image of themselves. And so you begin to then see, like, you know, you have certain writers such as William Gardner Smith, who begins to become, he becomes an expatriate and writes about the United States, you know, in France. And so you begin to see, I guess one of the reasons why I've done this project is to kind of tap into a history of black internationalism. And normally when people think about black internationalism, there are numbers of people that they cite, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, and people who I think are very rightly, you know, citable, and you should think about this. But I think less attention is given to the idea that you had, in some cases, millions of black soldiers circulating around the globe, changing culture. And that itself had a demonstrative impact upon how people began to see themselves. The idea of seeing yourself reflected in the eyes of an other or the other, I think, has an impact upon ideology. And so, and that also, I'd say, you know, I know I'm going on for a little bit, but it also has an impact upon the notion of the Cold War as well. Because during the Cold War, it became clear that the idea that anti-black racism was being used as propaganda. And so you then have the U.S. military deciding that, you know, and the U.S. government saying that, listen, we have to actually make some reforms back in the United States because we can't, you know, this is, we are being made to look like fools. So there are a number of impacts of the return of the turn of black soldiers, I think, that we should really think about seriously alongside of some of the other narratives that we understand. No. This is a term coined by I would say, actually, scholars. And so that wasn't a term used during that time. But I would say that this is a term coined by scholars who in some ways, you might call them post-Foucauldian scholars. So Foucault, I think, is one of the theorists that people use as a way of thinking about the idea of biopower and biopolitics, which is a term I think is very interesting in terms of thinking about the way in which life is managed. And so the kind of management of life is I think, at the root, at the notion of biomedical citizenship, that the idea that if you're able to manage people's lives in a correct way, then you can raise them to the level of acceptable citizenship. So this is not a term that I've coined, but it's a term that's grown out of lots of theorization about the use of power and how power can be understood as something that is both immaterial and at the same time tangible and can be tracked down to certain practices. Well, you know, it's amazing because you know, I wish my father was here because, you know, he would shake your hand and completely agree with you. He himself retired as a chief master sergeant in the Air Force, and I know that I can speak from my own experience what it's meant to grow up as a military brat, and that so I grew up in England and Japan. I was born in California, and so the way in which I began to see the world was a world that was in the military that had already had a number of these advancements that I have to admit that coming back to the States after I graduated high school in Okinawa, I began to realize that the world that I was then inhabiting was not the same kind of world that I inhabited on a military base, in the Pacific Ocean. That the kind of advancements, to me, they just weren't advancements. Just, you know, hey, what's up, you know? I didn't think that I made friends based upon you know race. It was more about, you know, at least the story I tell myself. I made friends based upon interest, and I began to see that in some ways I think it's something that really needs to be taken seriously is looking at the military as a kind of laboratory, as in which a number of social experiments occurred. And a lot of the, you know, hard issues, because again, those moments of integration, but you know, between like 1948 and, you know, 1972, you know, they weren't easy. But if the military is a space that allowed a kind of a forced integration in terms of having people say that, listen, we are going to, whether it's because of military readiness, which I think in some ways, and in a kind of expediency, which I think is one of the things that happened, but as a way of sort of saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what kind of America are we interested in having here? The military and a number of these other federal agencies, I think, have to be taken seriously, and they have to be studied about the kind of advancements that they've had in American society. That's something I think that whether or not you identify as conservative or liberal or leftist, Democrat or Republican, it's important to take seriously because it is, for particularly as a historian, for me, what I love about the military is that, you know, people keep such great notes. You know, the archives are impeccable, and that's what allowed me to find so much information. And so I'm all about thinking about the military as having an important role in the Constitution of America that we know today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.